Well, hello. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Stephen Palmer and I'm on the Executive Committee of Approval Project. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Saul Leofoid today, who is going to give the annual lecture. And Saul is the, as I'm sure you all know by now, the co-founder and co-executive director of the Death Penalty Project, which is based in the London Offer of Science Muirhead at Burton. And so we all like to think that this legal action charity, which does a tremendous job, has less work to do year by year. But unfortunately, this does not seem to be the case. Recently, there have been a series of wave of political executions in Iran following the protests in January. And Israel has also recently passed a controversial law in March this year, making the death penalty mandatory for Palestinians convicted of killing in terror-related cases. So the work of this charity continues to be of the utmost importance, and we're all grateful that this charity takes on this work. And that's really all I wanted to say to really welcome Saul, and we're looking forward to your lectures. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Stephanie, for that introduction. Thanks, everybody, for giving up your time. Stephanie said, death penalty does seem a road to lots of us who have grown up, often generationally, in abolitionist countries where the death penalty is seen as something from that horrible history of some medieval days in the past. But clearly, it's with us. It's not with us everywhere, but it's still with us. In lots of different countries around the world. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just sort of do a whistle-stop tour of what is going on in the world, but also sort of to look at Commonwealth in particular. And the reason why I talk about Commonwealth is because as an organisation and based in the UK, a lot of our work is focused on Commonwealth countries who retain death penalty. So I've tried to draw some analysis looking at what is the picture in the Commonwealth as a whole when you compare it to the rest of the world to see whether the Commonwealth is in line, is ahead, or is somewhere else when one looks at death penalty curve and abolitionist trends. And then to question why that might be the case. And obviously the Commonwealth is a very mixed cohort of countries, very, very diverse. If you think of the 50 plus countries that make up the Commonwealth family, it is incredibly diverse. So it's often difficult to talk about Commonwealth as one community, but they are bound by certain human rights principles, which I'll come to talk about. And I feel that it's important to look at what's going on in this subset. It's 25% of the world's nations, a little bit more, make up the family of Commonwealth nations. Every year I give these types of talks, I definitely feel that we're winning the battle to abolish the death penalty globally. And I think that the data and the numbers bear that out. So I've been working on this issue now for a long, long time, the first 3 years. And the global landscape's definitely changed over that period of time. And certainly mentioned that our organization is based at a board firm called Silas Year at Burton. Well, that firm's been involved in death penalty litigation for 50 years now. It's actually the 50th anniversary of a firm providing pro bono assistance. The first real landmark case was a case in 1976, called Frosis E. Belli. So people study law in this room. You may come across that particular judgment looking at clemency, the right to clemency, and it's very famous judgment by Lord Didcot in that case. And that was the first case that our firm were involved with. And I'll take you through a little bit more of the litigation. But what I'm interested in talking about today is looking at the motivation that's created this dynamic for change. What are the motivating factors? Why have more and more countries rejected the death penalty as an abuse of human rights? And where does the Commonwealth stand on this particular issue? So I won't talk too much about our organisation. You can find it on the internet, on the World Wide Web. We're a legal action NGO. We have consultative status before ECOSOC, one of the main UN bodies. We've had that for 10 years, which allows us to engage at the UN level. And essentially, when we started, we were providing 100% of our work as litigation. So we were providing free legal representation to people who face a death penalty in the Caribbean. And the connection is that a court in London called the Judicial Commissary Council. People heard this court, some will, some won't. It was formerly the Colonial Court. So at the height of the British Empire, a selection of judges in the UK who were members of the House of Lords had a jurisdiction to determine all appeals from British colonies, okay, around the world. So at one point, that court had jurisdiction over two-thirds of the world. Finally, all that is true. And as the British Empire diminished and countries became independent, the vast majority of countries, Australia, for example, abolished appeals to the Privy Council at the point of independence. Okay, so the court died with independence. But some countries kept that court as the final court of appeal post-independence. And a number of those countries, particularly in the Caribbean, they also had capital punishment. So people were facing the death penalty. Final apex court was in London, and lawyers needed to provide pro bono legal assistance to people facing the death penalty in those countries. And our firm provided that service to people who needed to appeal against their convictions and death sentences. Otherwise, they simply wouldn't be able to access that particular tribunal. So that's the kind of history of why London law firm, the UK abolished that was in 1965, is still today engaged in litigation in London for people who face a bounty of other countries. So that's a very brief explanation as to why we actually do this work and why the family partners of our firm decided to do the work back in the mid-1970s. What we do today is quite different from what we did in 1976. We still litigate on behalf of people who face the death penalty. That is part of what we do as a legal action organisation. And that takes many forms. So we're involved in criminal appeals, we're involved in constitutional appeals. So most countries have a Bill of Rights that's enforceable in court, so we can assess whether the criminal statutes that provide for the death penalty are compatible with human rights provisions contained in constitutions. Okay, this is quite a basic function, but a critical function when it comes to capital punishment. We've taken hundreds of cases to international human rights tribunals over the years, again, assessing whether countries are meeting their international obligations in respect of how they apply and use capital punishment. And from an academic perspective, what's been so interesting over the last 20 to 25 years is this process of harmonization of international standards and the domestic legal landscape. So you've seen that standard setting at an international level has been brought into by the domestic courts in lots of countries, not all countries, but the judiciary have been amenable to look at countries' international human rights standards and obligations and to see how they can make those real in terms of constitutional human rights protections as well. What the constitutional litigation has done, so if I just wind back, most countries in the Commonwealth inherited the British death penalty system. Okay, so that's the starting point. So what did the colonial or British death penalty system look like? Well, it was a mandatory sentence of death, which meant that if somebody was convicted of an offence, classically murder, the judge would have absolutely no discretion except to impose a death sentence. Okay? Clemency was written into the Constitution, the prerogative of mercy, but people really didn't have a right of access to that executive body. And clemency, there would be no transparency, there would be no process. And you were lucky to get clemency, it was seen as a grace rather than a right, okay? So these were and the execution was carried out by hanging. These were the sort of basic features of the British system. It was inherited in all Commonwealth countries. The only exception to that was India. So in India, there was a model of discretion contained within the Indian Penal Code 1861. But all other Commonwealth countries inherited the mandatory death penalty by hanging. a lot of the litigation that we've been involved with over the last 20 to 30 years has been trying to dismantle the most egregious aspects of that colonial death penalty regime. So the most obvious area has been to undo the mandatory death penalty, to argue that the mandatory imposition of the death penalty is arbitrary, disproportionate, cruel, violates fair trial standards, and that judges should have the ability to decide whether a death sentence is the appropriate sentence to be imposed, and for the judge to have the power to impose correct sentence, and for the death sentence to be the maximum and not the only sentence. Okay. I mean, obviously, we might argue that the death penalty shouldn't be there at all, but for lots of complicated reasons, that's an argument that's very, very difficult for us to make. So we use these legal techniques to restrict the use of the death penalty, okay, to make sure that judges have a discretion. When they have a discretion, to make sure that the presumption is life and not death, and so we ensure that very few people actually are sentenced to death, and that's been hugely successful. Now, engaging governments and commissioning research, that's about 50% of our work now. So you find abolition is very unlikely to happen in courts. The vast majority of countries, 90% plus, abolition happens in parliaments, okay? And there are some exceptions to that. South Africa is an obvious exception where the constitutional courts abolish the death penalty. Some Eastern European countries, Albania, Ukraine, abolished the death penalty through the constitutional courts. But by and large, abolition happens in through the parliamentary process. And that's how it is abolished in the UK. So litigation is good. It saves lives. It puts the death penalty within a human rights framework. But it doesn't necessarily lead to abolition. So we've got to talk to policymakers about abolition. And the commissioning of original research, and I can talk about that at length, but I'll not do it briefly, has really helped us to convince policymakers that there is a better way. The death penalty is a really weird thing. People have so many assumptions and misconceptions around capital punishment, more than anything else that I can think of when it comes to policy. And to defeat those assumptions and misconceptions, you know, there's some great people around the world that work in this area, and we all fail on our own just through our voices to convince people. But academic research, empirical data has been extremely powerful to convince people that the way they think about capital punishment is wrong, okay? For lots of reasons, not from an emotional perspective or a moral perspective, but from an empirical perspective. And we've seen in recent years, and we see this in three countries who have abolished in the last 5 years in Africa, that empirical research was the key tool to convince the parliamentarians that abolition was the correct thing to do. So research and engagement is really a key to ending the death penalty in many jurisdictions. And if people have got questions about what does our research look like, it could be looking at who's on death row. There are assumptions around who's on death row. And for example, an organization that two people in this room are very familiar with, having worked at the Square Circle Clinic, they're now known and did a survey, the London study, and they got to everybody on death row in India. And through that survey, they were able to show the people who ended up on death row were the least powerful members of society. They were the marginalized, poor, and violent. And that is atypical of death rows around the world. And that research really humanized the death penalty system. Now, India hasn't abolished, but it's part of the jigsaw of creating a different narrative and new conversations around capital punishment and debunking lots of myths. Our organization we're not famous, but we're known for our public opinion research. And one of the key excuses, I'm not going to say justifications, excuses of governments who don't abolish is the simple line that the public want the death penalty, therefore we cannot abolish. And we dig a lot deeper behind that abstract binary yes or no, and find out what the public know about the death penalty and what the public think about death penalty based on real life scenarios. And that research was extremely powerful in Zimbabwe and in Ghana.
when they evolve to don't dance because we're able to show part of it but not actually particularly interested actually, or wed it to the death penalty. And again, that was an assumption of parliamentarians and they couldn't abolish for that particular reason. So research has been essential to some of the work we've done. I won't spend too much time talking about international human rights law, but if one digs a little deeper into international human rights law, you will see that although the death penalty is still legitimised, it is incredibly restricted in the interpretation of when, how, and who could be sentenced to death. And one also has to remember that all of the main human rights treaties and instruments, so this is from the ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which has been ratified by nearly all countries of the world. This was drafted at a time in 1966, it came into force in 76, and hardly any countries had embraced abolition. So the language was of its time, similar to the European Convention. So these treaties were drafted and they were signed and ratified by countries at a time when most of the world had the death penalty. They're dynamic, they evolve, and the current interpretations of these particular treaties now give a lot of moral force to abolition because the circumstances in which the death penalty can be used are so limited that one could argue that it's virtually impossible to utilise capital punishment in accordance with human rights obligations because fair trial standards are incredibly tight in capital cases. Clemency can't be a grace, it has to be a real right, has to be transparent, there has to be procedural fairness. The death penalty can only be imposed in the most serious cases of intentional homicide. No other offences fall within international human rights law. And ultimately, all countries must be on an irrevocable path to abolition. So that is the current standing of international human rights law. It's very, very clear that it aspires to abolition. And this is consistent with all treaties around the world, whether it's the American Convention on Human Rights, the African Charter on Human People's Rights. This is the direction of travel of international human rights law. And it's moved very quickly. Okay, so just in terms of movement and pace of change, every 2 years, there's a vote at the United Nations General Assembly in response to a call for worldwide moratorium on the death penalty. And you can measure the pace of change by looking at how many countries support this resolution, how many countries vote against it. The first resolution was introduced in 2007, and you can just see how many more countries each time there's a vote in favour of the resolution and the diminishing number of countries who vote against it, okay? Now, the pace of change, not just here, but if you go back, so 1966, the year after the year that England won the World Cup, the year after the UK abolished the penalty, there were only 26 abolitionist nations in the world, okay? So hardly any countries in the world had embraced the abolition of the death penalty. If you move forward 20 years, so towards the end of the 1980s, that number was still small. It doubled to 52. So that was still around 25% of the world's nations, at that time 28%. Now we're at 124. So this movement is very, very fast in a historical perspective. So you've gone from virtually nothing in 1966, so 60 years ago, to over 65% of the world's nations have now abolished the death penalty in very, very short space of time. This is the picture now today, where we are today. If we talk a little bit about this. This is sort of classic UN categorization of countries and where they stand on the death penalty. And we'll talk a little bit about this. So if you group the first two together, so abolitionists for all crimes or for ordinary crimes, that's 124 countries. Okay, that's 63% of the world's countries no longer use death penalty. The 10 that keep it for ordinary crimes are effectively abolitionists. Okay, I mean, the UK was in that 10 up until not very long ago. We abolished it for murder in 1966, but only for other offences in 1998. Okay, so we have the death penalty for some offences up not very long ago. But they were never going to be used. They were weird offences like arson in a Majesty's stockyard. Kind of really weird historical offences. So let's kind of wrap up process. You then got this category, and I'll come back to it, which I'll abbreviate to ADF, I should say FATA, and that's 42 countries. And then you've got 70% of the world's nations who are categorized as retentionists. ADF means that you have a death penalty, you may sentence people to death, but you have not executed for 10 years. Then you're in an ADF group. Retentionists are countries who have parallel executions within the last 10 years. But if you dig deeper, okay, these are big numbers, and if you look at, well, of the 33 retentionists, do we really use death penalty? Well, more than 90% of all their executions are carried out just three countries. Okay. So although 33 countries have it, and some use it, and have used it in the last 10 years, the big numbers are restricted to very few countries. Now, the rider is, I'm not including China or Vietnam or North Korea in this data because we don't have the numbers. Okay, so we just paid out that equation. We know that China, large numbers of executions happen hereditarily. We'll say that Vietnam or West Africa, damn. You just don't know about North Korea, but we can imagine. But in the countries where data is available, three countries in 2024 were responsible for 91% of the world's executions, and they were Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. Last year, 2025, Iran is taking center stage, over 1,600 executions last year in Iran. Huge number. That's, in Iran itself, that's an increase of 70% of executions took place in Iran last year. But in 2024, only 15 of those 33 countries have executions. There's a really small number of active retentionists. Okay. We can talk about the US, but I'm not going to, that's on time. But I mean, even in the US, I mean, just a brief comment about the US. Even in the US, the picture is moving away from anti-assassin nuns. So 23 states have abolished, about 50. And 32 are not carried out as an execution for 10 years, the minimum. So the majority of us does not use death penalty. And in terms of death sentencing, that's declining rapidly. So if you went back to the mid-80s, over 300 people were sentenced to death annually. Last year, it was the 20s. Okay? So as I mentioned, they have a very large death row population, over 2,000 though in the US. People know in recent decades that based on death row. So it's kind of fluctuating position. It depends on the politics of the day as well. When it comes to federal death penalty, under Biden, no executions, Trump, much more use of the federal death penalty, which is not particularly surprising. But although we're kind of winning, we certainly haven't won. And we reckon today there are nearly 30,000 people that are housed on death rows around the world. So that's a lot of people. So there's still lots and lots. Now, what's created this sort of shift in the discourse on capital punishment? For me, this is a really deep subject, and I'm just going to be very, very superficial. I think if you went back sort of 40, 50 years, and countries who have it out say it is our decision, it's our national sovereign decision what we do with our captive citizens. Okay? We want to execute them, that's up to us. So, based on our culture and our development, we decide what are the weapons of our criminal justice policy, and that was acceptable. Today, that is not really seen as acceptable. And universal human rights principles have overtaken that sort of narrow view of criminal justice policy based on what we now know about death penalty, whether it's wrongful convictions, whether it's ideas about deterrence. Things have moved very rapidly. And I think that most countries, especially those who have abolished, accept that the death penalty involves principles of universal human rights, unavoidably. The right to life, a prohibition on inhuman and degrading treatment, the right to a fair trial, equality, discrimination, the rule of law. These principles come into play with death penalty, unavoidably. And once you say that, then abolition is somewhere, you know, in that, in good time. But the real question I want to just come on to today, briefly, is a sort of theory, is are those principles, those two last bullet words, have they been accepted throughout the Commonwealth? And in some Hampshire, surely, yes, they have. I mean, UK, Australia, Canada, but throughout the Commonwealth, what is the position? And the position is really, really surprising when you dig down. So here I've divided this into Commonwealth countries, 56 Commonwealth countries, and everyone else. Okay. And you can see, just by the colour shade, that when you look at sort of abolitionists in the rest of the world, it's nearly 70%, 99 countries. In the Commonwealth, it's 45%. Okay, so less Commonwealth countries have abolished than other countries. Retentionists is very similar. Okay, there's not much difference. The real difference is in this ADF category. It's countries that have the death penalty and not exercising executions. So in other countries, it's 13%. But amazingly, Commonwealth is 43%. So the 56 countries of the Commonwealth account for 50% of the world's ADF countries. And why is that? And what does that mean? And is ADF okay? These are the questions, just to dig a little bit deep. So in terms of frequency and diminution of executions, Commonwealth is quite similar to the rest of the world. But the willingness of Commonwealth countries to abolish the death penalty altogether is like, okay? And now, discussion, why in the Commonwealth are countries hanging on to the death penalty, grimly hanging on to the death penalty? They're not really executing many people. Only one Commonwealth country is executed in the last few years, which is St. Paul. But they don't want to watch. So that's the dynamic in Commonwealth. And you can see it again. This is just a backup. This is looking at the votes of the UN. So other countries, 74% of the rest of the world are voting in favour of a resolution. But only 29 Commonwealth countries, around 50%, are voting in favour of a resolution. And against the rest of the world is 12%. Against the resolution, Commonwealth is nearly 30% are voting against the resolution. And it's problematic because it, you know, at this international stage, the Commonwealth are blocking abolition. So if you think that 13 countries are in the Caribbean, 12 of those are voting against the resolution. That tiny pocket of small countries has a huge impact globally. So it is important in terms of the impact they're having at an international level. And this sort of desire, as I say, to hang on to the death penalty. Now, when it comes to ADF, I mean, I personally don't like abolitionists de facto. Why should they be even called abolitionists? Nigeria is about to come into ADF territory in August. It's nearly 10 years since they've had an execution. I mean, can anybody just have a guess? How many people do you think are on death row in Nigeria? Just guess. Four thousand people on death row. Bangladesh, 2,650. I was in ADF, by the way, but I just throw that in. But 4,000 people on death row, and they're called abolitionist de facto. I mean, then you have to understand, what does death row look like? What's it like to be on death row? What are human rights consequences of being told by a judge, I'm sentencing you to death, and you're going to be housed in a very different, distinct part of the prison, under a very different, distinct regime, and you're going to live in this position of uncertainty. Now, you may know that Bunch wasn't carried out an execution for many years, and may not even know that. The reality is, Mr. Audley won't know that's true. As far as you're concerned, you have your sentence of death, and what comes with that stigmatization for your family, a lack of visitation rights, inability to education, rehabilitation in prison because you are sentenced to death. So there are huge human rights consequences with the death penalty, even without executions. And also it can change. ADF countries can return to execute. It's a political decision. It can change. So ADF is a really vulnerable place to be. Now the old thinking was, and we have these arguments all the time within our death penalty community, that some people say ADF's great because you know that ADF's gonna lead to abolition. And that was the old thinking. But there, ADF is 37 years on average in parole for a country to remain in this ADF state. It's not necessarily a progression to abolition, it's a progression to nowhere. And I think even without executions, what it does, and I might say this for people after a Q&A or chat, even without executions, the death penalty has this sort of potent symbolic value of state power, which is unfortunate. And it comes with the death penalty, whether it's the judge who imposes the death sentence, and we know from certain countries where we've interviewed judges, how they feel about their power to impose death services, whether it's governors in certain states in Nigeria, they have power to issue death warrants, is a really uncomfortable area. And it's we've written a report recently on ADF. And the final point about ADF is, what's interesting about ADF is, it used to be 40 years. But when ADF first came about, the UN, first of all, it was 40 years. You had to be 40 without an execution before you slipped into the ADF. Then you were called ADF. Now it's 10. And I think that needs to be rethought. I mean, words and terms and describing, I don't know how much it matters, but I'd be more comfortable with suspended retentionists or something like that, but not abolitionists. They're not abolitionists at all. So that's my main bag here. Now, okay, so the Commonwealth. Well, what can we do about the Commonwealth? Well, the Commonwealth is bound by human rights principles. That's a surprising thing. There is a Commonwealth Charter. There are tons of declarations, just made a few of them, that follow the Commonwealth Charter. But the Commonwealth Charter confirms the commitment to the universal declaration of human rights and respect to rule of law. Okay, so there's a legal basis within the Commonwealth to exercise some kind of understanding or some examination. Is the death penalty compatible with those principles? So somebody in the Commonwealth could do that, whether it's the Commonwealth Secretariat, whether it's Australia, whether it's the UK, whether it's Canada, whether it's a number of countries. Is membership of the Commonwealth contingent on abolition? We have these human rights principles. Should it matter or not? You know, or does Commonwealth mean nothing? You know, when it comes, does Commonwealth Trust actually mean nothing? And it's not just about, I'm using the death penalty as an example of a human rights issue. There are tons of human rights issues that cut across nation states. It's to do with gender, it's to do with sexuality. There are all sorts of human rights issues. Again, linked to colonial laws, obviously. You know, and should the Commonwealth be more active? They have, the law is there, the Spaniards are there, the principles are there, but are they doing anything about it? And why I say that my argument is that they need to, and it's simply because international law says the death penalty is okay and restricted standards. But when you dig a bit deeper, it's not okay, because the death penalty inevitably violates the prohibition on human degrading treatment. And this is a statement from one of the special rapporteurs. But we know already that delay on death row amounts to inhuman degrading treatment. We know that the method of execution will never satisfy the prohibition on inhuman degrading treatment. We know that the whole idea of killing, telling somebody that you are sentenced to death, that we are going to kill you at an appointed moment in the future, offends human dignity. We know that. So there's a very strong argument that the death penalty of itself, per se, amounts to a human degree of treaties and punishment. And there's a tension between a treaty that says an exception to the right to life is you can have the death penalty and you can execute people. But then you have this absolute prohibition on inhuman degrading treatment, and it's incoherent. So, you know, the argument, I think, is, and we're moving in that direction, that it's going to be very hard for a state to say, well, the death penalty doesn't amount to inhuman degrading treatment or punishment, when one looks at what does the death penalty actually do. And what I find so interesting is there's, we were involved in a lot of cases that challenge delay on death row. So how long people were spending on death row. And the courts accepted our arguments in a number of countries that to keep somebody on death row for a prolonged amount of time, where it is such terrible anguish and torment, that after a period of time it violated the prohibition on inhuman degrading treatment. Now the court set an arbitrary period of time that doesn't make any sense, it's conceptually flawed, and said after 5 years, for example, or 3 years, you enter into the torture category. But surely after one day, it's the same principle. The psychological suffering is the same. So, you know, intellectually, philosophically, it doesn't make any sense. And the death row phenomenon, reasoning in jurisprudence, could just be applied to the death penalty of itself without any delay, to be frank. If you read those judgments and why the judges find delay to be offensive, or stop delay, it's the death penalty. But they've offended been reality. So that's, and then this is the real key, I think, which is arbitrariness is arbitrary acts are contrary to the rule of law. Okay? The executive cannot behave arbitrarily towards human beings. If you are to execute somebody and there's arbitrariness, that violates the right to life. And the question is to turn it round and say, can you have a death penalty without arbitrariness? And the answer is simply not. It's simply impossible. Because you can look at different systems. If you have a mandatory death penalty, that is clearly disproportionate and arbitrary. Because everybody in a group is sentenced to death in spite of being an individual and individual circumstances, who you are, what you did. And it treats a mass of people as one. If you change that and you bring in judicial discretion, well, then it's just a whole spat of subjective decision-making by human beings that decides whether person A is sentenced to death as opposed to person B. And we know from research that's been done asking judges these questions in India, we've done it in Bangladesh as well, some judges send lots of people to death and some judges don't send anybody to death. So it's a question of which judge you're before, not the law, is random. And if you dig deeper and you look at factors of gender, religion, race, poverty, these are factors that really determine, these are non-legal factors, right? These are the real factors that determine whether you're going to be sentenced to death and whether you're executed at the end of the day. And I think these uncertain, unpredictable, features that all count the punishment systems just render the whole death penalty arbitrary at the end of the day. And that is a serious vice, and it offends international human rights law, it offends constitutional law, but most importantly, it offends the rule. So I think the Commonwealth needs to think that if that is right, if what I'm saying is correct, and then they really need to examine whether countries who keep the death penalty really are fitting within the paradigm of what the Commonwealth stands for. What does it stand for? Ultimately. So I think arbitrariness is a huge, huge problem. And these facts really do determine, in reality, who is sentenced to death. There's no question about it. It could be the quality of your lawyer. If you're mentally ill and you're not seen by a psychiatrist or a psychologist, most people aren't. The amount of people that we've represented on Heal who are seriously ill and they've never been seen by a doctor. And the minute we introduce new evidence from a mental health practitioner, the condition cannot stack. So what's the determining factor that they were lucky to get an NGO that had the resources to get a pro bono psychiatrist to assess them, who present evidence to court? But, you know, that's one in 100 of 28,000 people on death row. So I think that's a real serious issue. And this is a great quote from Justice Dagwalt in India, arbitrariness and the vice of arbitrariness. So I can quickly wrap up. So, okay, if you look at sort of different developments in the Caribbean, I mean, sorry, the Commonwealth. First of all, the Commonwealth is really reluctant to challenge those countries who are still actively retentionists. So the few that fit into the retentionist category, Singapore. Singapore is executing at a hugely increased rate in recent years. These are all drug cases. That is in clear violation of international human rights law. The Commonwealth says absolutely nothing to Singapore. Completely silent. Bangladesh the same. I'm sure those have nothing to do about its use of capital punishment, or the expansion of capital punishment to non-lethal offences. Science. Where there's been progress is not because of Commonwealth institutions leading that progress. So the Caribbean has been judicial progress to restrict death penalty. And in sub-Saharan Africa, again, that is political appetite for abolition is not because of the Commonwealth. So there are advances. There are countries and regions where there's been really good progress away from the death penalty, but it's not because of Commonwealth. Or Commonwealth membership, or Commonwealth institutions, or leadership from the Commonwealth in that. These are other factors that are leading countries away from the death penalty. And there are some examples that we found where the Commonwealth has said something about capital punishment. And here's a few, I mean, these are all, but we could find that shit. They are so selective and random and inconsistent. So, you know, the best we can say is it's a fragmented approach. But I think that's theory come not too much credit to say that. So I didn't think it's an approach. It's a big grander criticisms of Commonwealth countries where they have clearly moved to executing in principle cases. So just to stop, my own view is there's a need for Commonwealth leadership on this issue. Where that comes from, it should be the abolitionist nations within the Commonwealth need to lead, because they're abolished for a reason. And silence is no good. And I think the UK, for historical reasons, is not the right country to be pushing this issue within the Commonwealth frame. I think that will go down well. But other countries in the Commonwealth, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, they should be really leading the charge within the Commonwealth context to push for the Commonwealth to take a stand on capital punishment. And whether that's questions about membership, which is, that's very strong, that's not gonna happen. But even to question would be interesting thing to do. And ultimately for the Commonwealth to say this is a core value, that we respect human life of all people and human dignity of all people. And that would make not just a difference within the Commonwealth, if you go back to some of the early reports, it would have a huge global impact. Because Commonwealth countries are blocking, you know, certain international initiatives to move, you know, universal abolition of capital punishment. So that's my son. Raises lots of questions. There's lots we can talk about. So I'll start there and happy to take any questions, comments, and chat about some of these issues. Thank you very much.